Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week, Dar Jamail returns with part two of his talk on the climate crisis and what to do about it. I hope you'll stay tuned. This week, we return for the conclusion of Dar Jamail's well-researched and very sobering talk on our global climate crisis. This crisis is extremely grave and very far along. And, as you can see, our political rulers and the corporate-controlled media are doing next to nothing even to spread awareness of the problem, let alone doing anything to help. They would rather preside over a planet in flames than douse the profits of their patrons, the corporatocracy. The corporate-controlled Obama administration did precious little about the climate crisis. The corporate-controlled Trump administration is actively taking steps to make the situation worse. And the corporate-controlled mass media are doing everything in their power to make you focus on minor issues and trivia and not think about any of the big problems. Problems from which their patrons profit grandly. Those are my words, but at a couple points in the Q&A, Dar Jamail said pretty much the same thing. Researching his book, Jamail spent 9 years traveling around the world. He personally investigated many places suffering from climate change. He interviewed in depth several top scientists, as well as ordinary people, and especially indigenous peoples in different lands. His new book of 2019 is titled The End of Ice. Jamail gave the talk we're hearing in Syracuse, New York, in April 2019. This week, in the second half of his talk, Jamail does two things. First, he steps back to give what he calls the macro view. Statistics that will make your heart sink, and the obvious conclusions to be drawn. Then, he considers the topic, what to do. As Jamail sees it, it's too late to prevent disaster, and it's probably too late to mitigate the disaster much. As the ground crumbles beneath our feet, or perhaps burns beneath our feet, we need to know how to act morally and ethically. As a start, we need to reject the European industrial exploitative mindset that created the disaster, and we need to listen to the wisdom of indigenous peoples. Listening to part two of Jamail's talk, I am reminded of a few other voices we have heard on New World Notes. John Perkins, of course, the former economic hitman, whose life was transformed by some indigenous folks in Ecuador. Another is climate scientist and activist Guy McPherson. His views of Earth's prospects are every bit as gloomy as Jamail's. Both men think that what we need to learn is how to spend our last days well. McPherson likes the metaphor of hospice. I think also of Chris Hedges. Both Hedges and Jamail stress the need for individuals to fight back, non-violently but strongly. In many of his talks, Hedges says that one has to resist evil, not because one is sure to succeed. One has to resist even when resistance seems likely to fail, because resistance is a moral imperative. And Jamail comes to pretty much the same conclusion. In fact, both Jamail and Hedges point to Czech resistance leader Václav Havel as an exemplar. But let us listen to Jamail. He starts off with the macro view. I'm going to start with a minute or so, here slightly condensed, that we heard last week. Here is Dar Jamil.
I want to step back and give some broad brushstrokes of the macro of how far along we are in the climate crisis now. Obviously, stopping it is off the table. Mitigating it is still out there in the ether as a remote possibility, but adaptation is what is upon us now. 2018 was the fourth warmest year ever recorded, with the only warmer years being 2015, 2016, and 2017. This past June was the hottest June ever recorded. Last month, July, was the hottest month ever recorded, period, on Earth since record-keeping began. We're currently in the middle of what is on track to be the warmest decade since record-keeping began. We're already in the sixth mass extinction event that industrial civilization has caused. We're injecting CO2 into the atmosphere at a rate 10 times faster than what occurred during the Permian mass extinction event 252 million years ago that annihilated 90% of life on Earth. Today's CO2 levels at 415 parts per million in the atmosphere are already in accordance with what has historically brought about steady-state temperatures on the planet between 4 and 7 C higher than they are right now, depending on where you are on the planet. What that essentially means is that the injury has already been done, i.e. this much CO2 in the atmosphere. We're just starting to watch the planet respond to what has been done to it. Temperatures have thus far increased 1.1 C over pre-industrial baseline levels. The oceans are now already literally overheating, deoxygenating, and acidifying. Insects, which are essential for the proper functioning of all of Earth's ecosystems, as they are food for other creatures, pollinators, and recyclers of nutrients, are in big trouble, according to recent studies. And to cut to the chase, without insects, humans simply cannot survive. They pollinate at least 75% of the food that we eat, among all these other critical roles in ecosystems. The studies that I mentioned inform us that we are losing 2.4% of global insect biomass annually, which means in less than 100 years at the current trajectory of loss, assuming there is no acceleration, there will be no more insects. Since just 1970, 60% of all mammals, birds, fish, and reptiles are gone. What would we call it if there had been a 60% reduction of humans since 1970? Several of the scientists I spoke with for the book said that if we had best case scenario, full stop of all CO2 emissions on a dime right now, we have a minimum of 3 degrees C warming already baked into the system. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, their worst case temperature projection scenario by 2100 is between 4 and 5 C. There's been several scientists come out very outspoken against the IPCC, making it very clear. Two of them actually IPCC authors that I've interviewed myself, saying this is not pure science. It's a heavily politicized organization. It's well known within the IPCC, and you can actually read it in their assessment and how they figure their projections yourself, that it's essentially consensus science. I use the term extremely loosely because how it works out is that the leading polluters, i.e. the U.S., Russia, China, India, et cetera, can weigh in on the projections and basically push them to the lower end because it suits their purposes better. So it's not a scientific organization, and this is not good science being used in the IPCC projections. And this is why consistently, as I mentioned earlier, their worst case projections, like right now for sea ice, literally as we speak, the sea ice melting is far above the IPCC's worst case projections from when they said it would be right now. So their worst case temperature scenario is between 4 to 5 C increase by 2100. The International Energy Agency, a pro-fossil fuel organization, has stated that preserving our current economic paradigm could guarantee a 6 C rise in Earth's average temperature before 2050. Shell and BP analysts expect the globe to be as much as 5 C warmer also by mid-century. So it is clear to me that that feeling I had when I wrote that article in 2013 and had what I've heard other people refer to as my fetal position moment of connecting all the dots, that we are genuinely in free fall and that we are off the climate precipice, because we're in a nonlinear situation of climatic disruptions and their effects, and we're locked into a course for uncontrollable levels of climate disruption that will bring starvation, destruction, mass migration, disease, and war here, as it already is in so many other places around the globe. There can no longer be any question that this life as we know it is ending. So this feeling right now in the room after hearing and taking in all of that, that is essentially where I arrived when I got to the end of the book and came to the conclusion and was trying to figure out basically how the hell do I conclude this book? Where do you go from here? How do we talk about this? What do we do with this? And so I had to start searching, not in the climate realm, not in the science realm, but more in the philosophical realm and in the spiritual realm. And thankfully, some certain things happened in my life that helped this process along that I really can't take credit for. One thing that happened was I came across a lecture of a guy named Stephen Jenkinson. He's a storyteller, a Canadian man who had worked in the palliative care industry for 3 decades. And he wrote a book called Die Wise, which is essentially about Western dominant culture's aversion to the acceptance of death as part of life. And he actually shared some, I think, very helpful things about grieving and the climate crisis during a lecture he gave at Simon Fraser University in Vancouver. Part of that, he was talking about the climate crisis, and I'd like to just read some of his words. The question is not, are we going to fail? The question is, how, he said. The question is, what shall be the manner of our inability to care for what was entrusted to us? The question is our manner of failing. He went on to say, grief requires us to know the time we're in. The great enemy of grief is hope. Hope is the four-letter word for people who are willing to know things for what they are. Our time requires us to be hope-free, to burn through the false choice of being hopeful and hopeless. They are two sides of the same con job. Grief is required to proceed. Another thing that happened literally as I was working on the conclusion of the book is a man named Stan Rushworth, a Native American elder of Cherokee descent, was brought into my life. And we started having some long conversations and spending a lot of time together. And he reminded me of the difference between the settler colonialist mentality of what are my rights, which is essentially the dominant culture mentality, versus a more indigenous perspective, which is that we're born onto the earth with primary obligations. The first one is to serve and be stewards of the earth. The second is to serve and protect and make decisions based on what's best for future generations of humans and all species. And so for me, when I get up each day and I approach my day from that perspective, I have my work cut out for me. There's no shortage of things that I can do for the planet and for other species and other people on the planet. If I can't think of anything, then that's a failure of my own imagination. And if I approach it as service work instead of, well, if I do X, will I get Y? Why take this action if things look so bleak and hopeless and so much is stacked against us? That'd be the same mentality of being on the Titanic and having a chance to help somebody and just saying, well, what's the point? We're all going down anyway. So it comes down to moral obligations and doing the right action because it's the right action. And it was around then that I came across a great quote from Vaclav Havel where he says, hope is not the conviction that something will turn out well, but the certainty that something is worth doing no matter how it turns out. So I'd like to read a few pages in conclusion now of some things that have that also came to me through Stan Rushworth that have helped me tremendously and I want to pass on to you. The first is a story that was shared with him by his elder, Dr. Darrell Wilson, who was born into the Pitt River Nation of Northeastern California. Wilson tells of Misa, a small but powerful spirit that inhabits Aku Yet, what the white man named Mount Shasta, a large volcano in Northern California. Misa is a spirit force that balances the earth with the universe and the universe with the earth. Wilson says that Aku Yet is, quote, the most necessary of all the mountains upon earth, for Misa keeps the earth the proper distance from the sun and keeps everything in its proper place when wonder and power stir the universe with a giant yet invisible canoe paddle. Misa keeps the earth from wandering away from the rest of the universe. It maintains the proper seasons and the proper atmosphere for life to flourish as earth changes seasons on its journey around the sun, end quote. The mountain, the story tells us, must be worshipped because Misa dwells deep within it. To climb the mountain with a pure heart and with real resolve, and to communicate with, quote, all of the light and all of the darkness of the universe, is to place your spirit in a direct line from the songs of Misa to the heart of the universe. While in this posture, the spirit of man slash woman is in perfect balance and harmony, end quote. For as long as Misa's instructions are followed with sincerity, society will be sustained. Its inhabitants will survive for the long term. Quote, the most important of all the lessons, it is said, is to be so quiet in your being that you constantly hear the soft singing of Misa. However, the story also warns that by not listening to Misa's song, the song will fade. Misa will depart, quote, and the earth and all of the societies upon earth will be out of balance and the life therein vulnerable to extinction. So when Stan shared that story with me, all of a sudden I realized this is why a guy from Houston, Texas has always had this love or this crazy love affair with the mountains, and why since I basically was a young adult have always oriented my life around living in proximity to mountains and spending as much time as I can up in them. And so the story I shared at the beginning about me being on a mountain and then getting a pull to just go to a rock. And the same thing happened with this book. I was at a point I didn't know what project to take on next, and I was just going into the mountains a whole bunch. And this idea came to me. And then here I am. And everything that kind of worked in my favor to have this happen, the same forces that worked in my favor to keep me alive several times in Iraq when I was over there, I believe that happened because I was doing service work for the planet. And so my point is the importance of going into that place of deep listening that Wilson talks about in this story, that I believe the fundamental core cause of the climate crisis is industrialized humans' fundamental disconnection from the planet. And before we start talking about what to do next or how am I going to react, I think for me personally, I've had to start with, I need to reconnect back into the earth as deeply and regularly as possible. And it is that part, you know, as I come to the end of my talk before we go into a question and answer session, it's usually obligatory for the speaker to offer hope or give people some things to do. And I want to end a little bit differently because I think the scope of not just the climate crisis, but the political crisis, the everything crisis. I mean, whatever your cause is that you work on, whether it's this or racism or sexism or gun violence or anti-militarism or anti-drones or, you know, go down the line, we are at a crisis point in everything. And so everything needs attention. More than it ever has before. And so rather than trying to give people things to do, I want to end with reading a little bit about something that Stan also shared with me. He teaches critical thinking and indigenous literature at Cabrillo College in Aptos, California, which is a small town just south of Santa Cruz on the coast of California. And Rushworth has regularly invited indigenous elders to speak with his classes, especially about what is the right relationship to the earth. And his students always ask the elders, who always get up there and take the full 3 hours and talk nonstop, they say, well, what can we do? And so one elder, Henry Tyler, an Arapaho elder, would stand and point with the fingers to his head and say nothing for several minutes. And then he would say, "Use this." And he would smile. Everything that he had said for the previous 3 hours would provide tools for those who chose to respond. He gave so much to reflect upon that a finger to the head was a powerful statement. CeeLo Black Crow, a Lakota Sundance leader and elder, would also smile and say, "Think about it. That's up to you. I can't tell you what to do. Educate yourself, then you decide." Of this, Rushworth added, "Like Uncle Henry, listening to him for 3 hours would give an incalculable amount of information and food for reflection." The common message these men offer, Rushworth believes, is that each person must come fully into their own agency and from that place decide upon their proper course of action. Otherwise, simply following the lead of someone else would entail a lack of the kind of conviction needed for these times. And I think now, given what we're seeing politically, the fascism that's happening, not just in this country, but other Western countries, and where the world is going, and how intense these times are, and how much more intense we all know they're going to get on all these levels, on all these issues. These are, I think, really critical, very deeply personal questions. Because I think we're going to get to a point where some of us are going to be making decisions about, am I going to put my life on the line for this? Am I going to go stand here and take a bullet? Am I going to go take an action that could jeopardize my safety or the people I love's safety? That these times they're already upon large segments of the population, and they're going to be upon, I think, all of us sooner rather than later. And in order to make that decision, that's where, for me, when I've made those decisions based on going to Iraq and decisions on whether or not I was going to go into Fallujah, those decisions had to come from a deep place of commitment that I only got from going out and essentially doing what Stan's story about Misa Misa finally articulated to me and showed me that's what I was actually doing, was listening to Misa Misa and then following the instructions that came and being quiet enough, consistently enough, and really listening. So wherever that is, whether that's in a place of meditation or if you're a nature person like me, it's up in the mountains or the rivers or the ocean or wherever. But I want to leave you with just two questions to end this, because I think this is the start and, in a sense, the ending point for all of us right now, is where is it that you go to listen to Misa Misa? And when was the last time that you went there to listen? Thank you.
What shouldn't be was. There are times when you gotta stand steady. There are other times when you gotta be ready. The window can open, seems so wide, but you can never tell when it's gonna slam shut. One day you're a target on the firing ranges, the next day all of a sudden everything changes. You know. real is what you do. Some moments are coming, others have came, and then there are those when you just gotta take aim.
A little classic David Rovix there. And before that, Dar Jamail, speaking in Syracuse, New York, on April 11, 2019. The original audio recording was made by Wilton Vaught, producer of the podcast Essential Dissent. You can find that show on iTunes, YouTube, RadioForAll.net, and elsewhere. Just do a search for Essential Dissent. Thanks to Wilton for the excellent recording. And thanks to you for listening to New World Notes. We come to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of that beacon of light in darkest Connecticut, the University of Hartford. You can find audio copies of this and all our shows at our website, which is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. On behalf of the entire New World Notes staff, this is Kenneth Doust, Chief Cook and Bottle Washer, advising illegitimi non carborundum, dust off that old bicycle, pump up the tires, remember that you are not alone, and please tune in again next week. Till then.